Accession number 18041, Reel 3.
The genius side took place most of the time, but the nutty side of it was unbelievable. And he had just arrived at that time in his career where he didn't bathe. He wore an old pair of khaki longs, open sandals like you have on, and a shirt with no buttons on it. He had started to grow the beard, but it wasn't down to here. I've seen photographs of down there, but it was a longish beard. Unhygienic sort of a guy with great long fingernails, with the rather unusual habit of sitting doing this, picking the dirt out of them. I didn't know this when we flew the aeroplane into Idlewild, as it then was, but we were met by Gordon Gilmore, Vice President Public Relations, TWA, with a fleet of Cadillacs and all the rest of it. Welcome job. And he was a real professional PR man. Very nice chap, Gordon Gilmore. Still keep in touch with him. And we were parked way, I don't know whereabouts in Idlewild, way down in the freight area near a TWA freight hangar. And as we came out of the aeroplane, there would be many of us, around six or seven yes. Thickest people.
I was trying to think who came from flight test. Myself, Bill Cairns, Derek Jones, two engineers, maybe there was just five.
The five of us, indeed it was five, stepped out of the aeroplane. Gordon Gilmore introduced himself, and I introduced him in turn to the Vickers contingent, and one or two other TWA people who were there, and Gilmore was apologizing profusely because Mr. Hughes was unable to be there. He was still in the West Coast. And out of the corner of my eye, I could see a certain amount of activity going on in the Viscount, including this door being closed and the stairs being pulled away, and a whole crowd of these New York guards, not official police, but dressed like police, with guns and such like, about four of them taking up each wingtip and the nose and the tail, and chocks going in. And he escorted us across to the Cadillacs to take us down, not to the Waldorf Astoria, but to the Waldorf Towers. Big deal. I'll have you know, we spent a few weeks there with General MacArthur, was a guest on that side was a fellow called Adolf Monge, you know, the film actor. Big deal. So just before we get into Cadillacs, I said, Gordon, just a shape, we would like to get our gear out of the aeroplane. And he said, Jock, I'm sorry, Mr. Hughes has given us instructions that when you land, and we met, the next person to go into that aeroplane is going to be Mr. Hughes. And I said, well, that's fine and dandy, I fully respect that. Meanwhile, we'll go and get our overnight kit in our cases because of spending the night in New York. I said, I'm sorry, Job. The next guy that goes in there is Mr. Hughes. I said, yeah, but he's on the West Coast. And he said, jump into the Cadillac, Jock has a Nuda, and you and I will go down in one car on our own. So I went along with the system. On the way into New York, he said, you must understand that Mr. Hughes runs a pretty big empire, blah, 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 and in our organization, if Mr. Hughes says he's the next man to get into that aeroplane, that's it. And I said, yeah, but how do we shave in the morning? How do we put on a clean shirt? He said, no problem at all. We'll go straight out and we'll reclothe you, all of you. You just go down, we'll take you out the store and you have anything you want to keep you going for the next few weeks. And I really couldn't believe this because this is a bit unusual. Well, we did that very thing, and we spent, I think, 3 weeks in the Waldorf Towers being phoned by Hughes at all sorts of times because he doesn't have a clock. He eats when he's hungry, sleeps when he's tired, he gets up when he's refreshed.
and the clock doesn't come into his way of thinking. So you were liable to be phoned up at 3 o'clock in the morning, as I once was, and he apologised profusely at the delay, but it was because they were pooping off an atomic bomb out in the test range in
Nevada?
Something like that. And he said, now if you fly the aeroplane across to me, I don't want it possibly to be infiltrated with any of the dust here, so until that atomic test is finished, you stay where you are, and by the way, pork is off the menu. Now, at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're right, as I say, I beg your pardon, 1 minute you're talking about eight tests in the Nevada desert, and the next minute, pork's off the menu. So I asked him to repeat it, and now, sure enough, this great Howard Hughes said, pork's off the menu. And I asked him why, and he said, well, there's been a glut of it, and it's strained our storage facilities, and when I want you to come out here, I don't want any of you with stomach trouble, so would you please?
No problem.
So when we had breakfast with Gilmore, who was locked up with us in this beautiful suite of rooms, the next morning I don't think I actually said this, but I used to say things like this until Gilmore put me right. I said, this idiot boss of yours pokes off the menu, and he said, the place might be bugged or such like, and he said, be a little more discreet, because Howard Hughes up to all the tricks. So I had to quietly tell him or write down that pork was off the menu. And he believed it, but the rest of the Vickers people couldn't believe me. And I remember that particular day when we had all our meals, we weren't allowed out of this suite, we were completely confined to barracks. And the usual sort of English peculiar way they have of going about the business, when the steward came in to take our orders for lunch, all five of them ordered pork chops. That was an absolute must. That was the great furore. And this nonsense went on for 3 or 4 weeks there, until they told us to take the aeroplane up to Montreal, to my old friend's Air Canada. And he would meet
Mr. Hughes didn't want to get into it first this time.
No. Take the aeroplane up to Montreal, and he wanted to do 100 landings, 50 day, 50 night. That takes a long time. I said, sure, that's no problem at all. So great panic to get out and off, and the phone called straight back again, and he said, Mr. Bryce, I've been thinking about you and the other British aviators. It would be wrong of me to ask you to fly that aeroplane up to Montreal, because I expect it straight off the production line, and you did the production test line, and I'll bet you the repeatability is pretty hot stuff. This is about the best Viscount off the production line this year. He's right, up to a point. And he said, just leave it where it is, and I'll arrange to borrow an Air Canada aeroplane. So we were flown up, I don't know how we got to Montreal, but we flew up anyway, and he had taken over the 9th floor of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. Do you want me to continue? Am I good? He had taken over the 9th floor of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, and I met him for the first time, this scruffy looking bugger, which is deaf as a doornail, and you couldn't get to the 9th floor, because all the doors were guarded by Hughes's entourage. And the middle suite of this great long hall with a bedroom, lounge, bathroom was Howard Hughes. Either side of him, the two suites were empty and locked up. His suite had lots of loudspeakers installed, because his telephone calls were all these boardroom telephone calls where he didn't have to hang on to anything. Then on the left-hand side, he had 7 personal assistants led by a fellow called Bill Gay. And on the other side of this setup, Ben DeSico had a telephone exchange installed there, a big one. And then down the other side, each of the British aviators had a suite of their own. When you've got the whole floor, you can be pretty generous with your guest accommodation. And I was wheeled into the presence, and
I decided that the way to play it was, I wasn't a salesman, I was a test pilot, and so was he, and a test pilot of some high standing too. And I was more than prepared to answer any questions, but I wasn't prepared to start trying to sell him aeroplanes, because he knew more about aeroplanes than I did. Things like spruce gooses and these funny fighters with big engines and contrary-taking props and flying around the world with wily posts. I kind of put them in a sort of a mini Mutt Summers category. And he didn't say too much, and he led up to it and he said, have you got the maintenance manuals for the Baikan? I said, no. He said, how many are there, five or seven? I said, well, I was with you, I don't know, but I think there's seven. Are there seven?
About that, yes.
And the pile up, yeah, big. I said, no, I don't have them. And I said, can you get them for me? I said, sure, my friends in Air Canada, I can get you the maintenance manuals. He said, right, you go and get them. I said, okay, Mr. Hughes, fine. So I phoned up George Lullin, and we got him his maintenance manuals, handed them in to him, and he thanked me. And he said, you'll have to excuse me now, I'm just about to have a, he had an expression for it, boardroom telephone call. So the secret was getting Jones in Singapore and Smith in Tokyo and somebody in Buenos Aires, about six of them, all piped into the speakers.
Mm.
And I complimented, I said, this is quite a deal we had. He said, you know, you don't need an office, all you need is a good telephone operator, a good telephone system. These are people all around the world, and I can do my business with them sitting here. Great. I didn't see him then for about 2 or 3 days, and when I next went in there, he thanked me profusely for the engineering maintenance manuals, and he must have a photographic mind, because I don't know any guy, apart from these design people, that knew more about the guts of a Viscount than that guy. Why have you got a production joint at station 341? I didn't even know what station 341 was, but that son of a bitch did. And I was fascinated at this guy, the information he had in that aeroplane. And as far as I knew, he started off 3 days previously. So he was 95% genius and 5% nuts. When he went flying, it was always done about 2-3 o'clock in the morning. I don't think
this was in the Viscount, did it actually?
Yeah. Oh yes, he did a lot of flying in the Viscount. And the first thing he did when he got into the Viscount, he produced the only clean thing about his person, a nice Irish linen handkerchief, and he tied it round here, cowboy style. And when we asked him, you know, a flight deck's a great leveler for human beings. It doesn't matter whether you've got Prince Philip's there or Howard Hughes. You can still get into an awful lot of trouble, and it's a mutual job. And he was asked, why the handkerchief? And he said, germs. And he was just beginning this kick about being worried about germs. So he's sitting this fight out with the thing going. And he flew, and he flew, and he flew the airplane. He flew it well, but he had a funny habit that George Lothian, the chief training captain of Air Canada, I couldn't fly the aeroplane as captain because it was their aeroplane and it meant Vickers taking it over. It's too bloody complicated. So George Lothian, who was more qualified to do it than I was, he flew in the right-hand seat. And Lothian was appalled. He was a perfectly safe flyer, but he was a Mutt Summers. And he had this funny habit of finishing up a good 2 miles from the threshold at 200 feet, everything down, flaps down, cock the nose up, lots of power on, and do what we would call a precautionary landing. He would drag the thing in like so, and all perfectly safe and such like, but it upset George Lothian's Air Canada hat. And he accepted it all. And
what did ATC have to do? What did ATC have to say about that? You know, way below the glide slope, they worry?
Well, I don't know how Hughes, he plays everything very quietly, driving up to the airport from the Ritz-Carlton Hotel at 2 in the morning to fly, but he would stop halfway up and change into another car and drive off in the next direction. Then he would circumvent the airfield and come in through a side door. His staff would fix air traffic control, and very quickly the whole world in aviation knew it was Howard Hughes, and I think they were afraid of him, or, you know, he had some mystique about him. And you make a good point there about driving it in. It was a perfectly safe operation, but I reckon he must have waked up a few people around Dorval and, you know, that type. So George Lothian said, "Right, Mr. Hughes, I must show you one thing." So off he went. He did a Air Canada pattern to perfection. Like, so touched the throttles about twice on the way round and came down. He said, "That's how we teach in TCA." And Hughes said, "Very impressed. Very glad to do that." Right, off we go. And 5 minutes later, at 200 feet, the nose dropped up. Exactly. George didn't worry about it, but the next time I was chatting to Hughes when he pulled us into his office in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, I asked him about this very diplomatically. And he said, "Well, I'll tell you, I have flown every civil aeroplane made by the Western world that I could get my hands on before the war and after the war. And I find that not having any chance to work up to it, I'm thrown in at the deep end. If I take a Stratocruiser or a 707 or a Viscount, there'd be no 707s then, whatever, a Convair, an 880 or something." He said, "If I get it a couple of miles back at 200 feet, everything down, it gives me a direct comparison." And that's a typical Mutt Summers way of going about things.
Yeah.
You still want me to continue?
Well, I think you never sold any planes to him after all that.
No, I think we tried to sell him the wrong one. Why didn't we sell him the 800s? Because we couldn't get this 700 over the Rockies. Why wasn't it the... I could never understand why we didn't have a go at the 800.
I think it was... My memory says we just about gave up. I mean, it was beginning to go from bad to worse. So,
yeah. And he was the monopolist commissioner in the States. They were taking away his control of TWA.
That's right. Call.
And also he sacked a fella called his financial director, who was called a well-known name. We were right in the middle of that. And Bill Gay told us why the financial director of the Hughes Empire, who controlled many, many, many millions of dollars, that's for sure, had been phoned by Hughes at his home when this financial director was he was entertaining, and he said, "I want to talk to you about so-and-so." "Yes, Mr. Hughes." He said, "Well, I'm not prepared to discuss it on your public telephone, your own phone. Hop into the car and go down to the nearest call box." And he put the phone down and said to his wife, "I've got to get the bloody car out and go down and phone up the boss." And his wife said, "God, you can't do that. Give it 10 minutes and ring him back from here, for God's sake. This nonsense is beginning to get in a wick." So he called Hughes back after the appropriate passage of time, and Hughes said to him, "Are you in a call box?" And he said, "Yes, Mr. Hughes. Now, what do you want to discuss with me?" He said, "You just give me the telephone number of that call box and I'll call you back." So he had to confess he was still at home. He said, "Right, you be in my office 7 o'clock tomorrow morning." Financial director or not, that was the end of the well-known... He wrote a book about it about 10 years ago. And that was old Hughes. He was a most extraordinary guy with some of the... Well, as I say, he was 5% nuts in the performances he went through.
You must have been driven absolutely up a wall with boredom all those weeks just sitting in a hotel suite, weren't you?
Yeah, well, I learned quickly, because after a few weeks in the Ritz, in the Waldorf Towers, our big trouble was lack of exercise, and we were not allowed. You couldn't get out of that suite. I once went down to try and walk around the foyer, and I stopped by a guard. I had to go back, and I complained furiously to go back.
The heaviest stopped you. The heaviest stopped you.
Oh, yes. And Gilmore said, I know, Joe, it's very difficult for you fella, but you've just got to go along with it. So once when I talked to Hughes, I said, we have a problem here, Mr. Hughes. We need some fresh air, and we are air crew, and I'm beginning to worry about our physical condition because I've been sitting doing pucker all and eating far too much and drinking too much for weeks now. We need some exercise, he said. I do apologise. I should have known better. Get me Gilmore. And Gilmore took the phone over and he said, yes, Mr. Hughes. Yes, Mr. Hughes. And I could see him turning a little bit white. So when he put the phone down, he said, Joe, you're in trouble. You should have kept quiet about that. To cut a long story short, a fleet of Cadillacs appeared downstairs. We were wheeled into them and taken to the New York Athletic Club, which is about 7 floors up overlooking Central Park. And I think only those and that such as those can become members of it. It's the Kennedy family and ex, you know, and the chairman of IBM. And in the usual American way, we were put into a production line there where we had 10 minutes in a gym, then we were flung into a hot bath, then we had to swim so many lengths, then a big Swedish guy came up and beat the hell out of us, and we, after 2 hours, we were completely exhausted, but we had been exercised, straight back to the suite of rooms. And one night he took sympathy on us, he said, or I had said something to him about being bored stiff, or more diplomatic than that, and he said, oh, well, wait a minute, there's a show on in New York, an English guy in it, and an English girl, I think it's a fella called Harrison. Yeah, Rex Harrison. No problem. Would you like to go there? Would we ever? So he got on to Gilmore again, and Gilmore put the phone down and said, you've dropped me in trouble because we have to be at My Fair Lady tonight, and there's no way you can get tickets. Well, I don't know what happened, but we sat 7 in a row in the second row of the stalls about 3 hours previously. And how Hughes arranged that, I'll never know.
Bought them. Off the
maybe he owned the theatre.
$1,000 a head or something, yeah.
Yeah, oh yes. Money. Money wasn't money to that guy or his staff. It was just a means that you had to exchange it for whatever you wanted.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, what about the testifying programme?
I don't know. I tried to phone George Edwards from Montreal because I was completely isolated from Weybridge, but we had a rep in Montreal called Norman
Wadsworth.
And I know George Lothian warned me about talking to him on the phone about Howard Hughes flying because the phones were packed. And I sometimes wasn't as switched on as I would forget, but I phoned up Norman Wadsworth. And quick as a flash, said, Norman, I have to speak to George Edwards. You name the time and where. Norman Wadsworth arranged for me to come down to his office, and it, as it happened, it was 2 a.m., because with the time differential, that means I could get through to George Edwards at 7 o'clock Bookham time. I had some difficulty in getting out of the hotel because all the exits and the lifts and such like were monitored by the Hughes people, but I think I got out through the kitchen, and Wadsworth's office was just half a block down whatever street the Ritz-Carlton was on, and round the block. He had already given me the keys of his office, so I went in there awaiting the call from Bookham, so I could check in verbally with George Edwards for the first time in several weeks, because I thought he must have wondered what was going on. And pretty nearly on the button at 2 o'clock, the phone rang, and I grabbed it up, a lifeline, talking to my boss in Weybridge, who would understand the predicament we were in, trap this guy, and Sir Helm, it was Bill Gay. And he said, I'm very upset, Jock, that you've taken this action, and I would appreciate it if you didn't speak to George Edwards. And would you, Mr. Hughes, would like you to come straight back to your suite. I stole that phone out there, ran back to that hotel.
He was sitting on every line then.
Hmm?
Was he sitting on every line?
I don't know. All I know was I blew my bloody top because I thought, if the chief despider of Vickers can't phone up George Edwards and give him a situation report, bugger Hughes. And anyone else, but I demand the right to phone up the managing director of Vickers Weybridge, nobody's going to stop me doing that. And I went straight up to Bill Gay, couldn't get anywhere near Hughes, I don't think he even tried. I went in and blew my top with Bill Gay, and he apologised profusely, and he said, that's what Mr. Hughes wants, and his word is law. And I said, well, I don't mind that so much, but what I don't like is the fact that you're obviously tapping our telephones, and I think that's out of order. He said, no, you're quite wrong. Mr. Hughes went out for a walk around the block, had some exercise, and he saw you leaving the back premises of the hotel, and he followed you and saw you go into the office in Drummond Street, and we knew whose office that was, and you weren't being spied upon. It was just your bad luck with Hughes. True or false, I don't know, but...
And your Viscount was still stuck at Idlewild all this time?
It lay at Idlewild for 11 months.
Good God.
And after 11 months, the towers were flat, rats had got into it, eaten most of the soundproofing, and we sent Colin Allen, and a BAC engineer from Arlington came up, and the aeroplane was in such bad shape it had to be taken to Capitals at Washington National to be duffed up. And Colin Allen flew that aeroplane with, nobody had done a bloody thing to it for 11 months. They had some special clearance, you know, they did the essential, like the oil tanks, and whether they drained the fuel out or not, I don't know, but he flew a very limp aeroplane from New York down to the maintenance hangars at Capital Airlines Washington. And the aeroplane, it flew just like a Viscount should. Quite extraordinary. I'm saying nothing else.
Anyway,
that was the, if you like, the original production Viscount. That was the 700 series. We then went on as more power became available, built the 800 series, and that opened up the market with the larger Viscounts for British European Airways and KLM, and then quite rapidly moved on to what became known as the 810 series. And the significance of this is another one of these great characters of the airline world appeared on the scene, Bob Six, who from Continental Airlines, and his basic operation was out of Denver, over the mountains to Los Angeles and up to Chicago. And the 800 series couldn't do it because it couldn't get over the Rockies with an engine out, but the 810 series with a more powerful Dart did. And once more, that brought in a great surge forward of sales. Sales to people like Lufthansa and South African Airways, more aircraft to Australia.